Mesa did that, which was closed on the right in the eyes of the Lord of God. President of the Riding of Julian to give us the results of his studies.
Well then, so learning from Asa's reforms and his victory over the Ethiopians. Well, as we've already seen, we won't spend much time on this because we've seen how these timings line up in more detail already. Just a brief overview just of where Asa sits. Of course, the son of Abijah, grandson of Rehoboam, the great-grandson of Solomon. And as Paul said, that puts it about 20 years after the kind of split of the two nations. And I found this diagram, which I found quite useful actually, just to visualize. I only just found this sort of as a late addition to the slide deck, which just, they've classified the kings as evil, good, and revival. I'm not sure I 100% understand the distinction between good and revival, but it perhaps indicates that kind of cyclic nature of the nation of Judah, how they kind of slipped in and out of favor with God, and how their fortunes wax and waned. And it probably sort of speaks to how gut feel of how it was when we read through those passages. But it's perhaps just an interesting little visualization of just how regular it is. So there's Asa in the first one in that pink band, sort of leading the recovery, shall we say, from the evil reign of Rehoboam and a questionable reign of Abijah. So in terms of timeline of Asa specifically, just a very simplistic timeline, just to hopefully set a little context for the things that we're speaking about, where they fit in the life of Asa. So essentially, sort of bullet-pointed list of what we've already read in that chapter, the 14th chapter. So the reign begins. We agree with Paul that, fortunately, because it's already on the slide, I also think the 10 years of quiet was at the start, so that's good. We're off to a good start here. Paul Carter disagrees, it's 2-1, so. The initial set of reforms, then the battle with Zerah, so those two points obviously are essentially going to be our talk. Prophecy of Oded, now we're heading into Paul Carter's area, I think. The oath. And we put secondary reforms as well. This is something I was a little unsure of at first reading, in fairness. Perhaps I'm a little easily confused, but particularly from the King's passage, it reads as if there was a single set of reforms which included everything. But then from the Chronicles passage, it seems to imply that there were, in fact, two rounds of reforms, mostly the same with a slight different twist. And I wasn't 100% sure in the Chronicles, whether it was just the way it was written, in the sense that sometimes we get a summary of what a king did, and then we get the events playing out in order. But I've come to the conclusion, I think there are two sets of reforms. I'm reasonably confident on that. Then there's a war with Baasha, and dies after a 41-year reign. So that, as far as I can see, is roughly sets the timeline of Asa's reign. As I say, we're going to be focusing, obviously, on those reforms, primarily the former set, since they're essentially the same for the most part, and the battle with Zerah the Ethiopian. So obviously reforms implies that there's something to be reformed from. And indeed scripture describes for us quite a bad situation, which sort of heading into this period. 1 Kings 14, speaking of the reign of Rehoboam, obviously the first of the divided kings, describes it thus in 1 Kings 14, 21. And Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city which the Lord did choose out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. And his mother's name was Naamah, an Ammonitess. And Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with all their sins which they had committed, above all that their fathers had done. For they also built them high places and images and groves on every high hill and under every green tree. There were also Sodomites in the land, and they did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord cast out before the children of Israel. So Rehoboam had taken the nation down this very dangerous path, this dark path, into all these sins which were common in the nations that they drove out. And his son, Abijam appears to have done little to have rectified the situation. So this is Rehoboam's son and Asa's father, just to clear up the contradiction on that title. In 1 Kings 15, we read, "Now in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, reigned Abijam over Judah. 3 years reigned he in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Maacah, the daughter of Absalom. And he walked in all the sins of his father, which he had done before him. And his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father." So it seems that while Abijam does appear to have got some things right, he doesn't seem to have done much or anything to reverse the trend which his father had set in motion. And so then we come to Asa with our title quote there. "And Asa did that which was good and right in the eyes of the Lord." And so thus begins this reforming reign. And of course, the question always comes to mind when we get these transitions between kings which were evil, heading sort of sweeping up, if we follow that that plot that was on the screen. Where does the good influence come from? And it's just perhaps interesting to speculate. I don't think we're told exactly. Perhaps one source might, seemingly contradictionally, be his father. And we've seen that his father was far from perfect, as we've just had on the screen, that he followed in the sins of his father, and yet he did have his good moments. In 2 Chronicles 13, just plucking a few verses to summarize the events, "And Abijah stood up on Mount Zeramim, which is in Mount Ephraim, and said, Hear me, thou Jeroboam, and all of Israel. Verse 8, And now ye think to withstand the kingdom of the Lord in the hand of the sons of David, and ye be a great multitude, and there are with you golden calves, which Jeroboam made for your gods. But as for us, the Lord is our God, and we have not forsaken him. And the priests which minister unto the Lord are the sons of Aaron, and the Levites wait upon their business." It's perhaps just interesting, while he's overall described as an evil king, it seems that he did have moments of clarity, or perhaps it was just something he said at the time to help stir the people up to his cause, picking on those differences between the two nations. We can't tell. Either way, he doesn't receive a high commendation, but perhaps there were some good influences from him at times, or perhaps it went the other way. We don't know. Obviously, another potential source of good influence is that of the prophets. We know, for example, later on, and Brother Paul's going to speak to this, I expect, we know that he was visited by the prophet Oded after the battle with the Ethiopians. We see in his later years, we see contact with Hanani the seer is mentioned. And perhaps there are others that we don't read about. And perhaps these two individuals, and as we say others, maybe there was other contact with Asa, perhaps in his formative years, which we don't know about. Likewise, the priesthood at the time. We've seen from that passage in which Abijam was making that speech. We know that he didn't remove the priesthood. He didn't have them thrown out or killed. They were still present, even if the nation was wayward. And we don't know, or at least I'm not aware, if there's any indication of the strength of spiritual leadership from the priesthood of the day. But maybe there were some good influences there, presumably on a young Asa, even before he took to the throne. So what were these reforms then? This good King Asa took to the throne. What did he seek to do? Well, as we've already seen, and this is really just what we've already read, primarily in chapter 14, 2 Kings 14, he removed the Sodomites. He removed his father's idols. He taught the law. There was a period of fortification and building. He removed the queen, which we're going to touch on, although that actually falls in the second set of reforms. So that appears to summarize the set of reforms which he took part in, or rather led, I should say. So taking those in order then, firstly, we read that he removed the Sodomites. In 1 Kings 15, we read, "And he took away the Sodomites out of the land and removed all the idols his father had made." So, hopefully it's we're fairly familiar with, obviously, the law. So it'd be no surprise to see the motivating commands for that. We're trying to follow a little pattern with each of these, incidentally, each of these reformers. Look at the passage where it's mentioned, the motivating commands behind that, relevant commands, and then some lessons we can draw from each one. So in the law, we read, "Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind." It's an abomination. So fairly clear cut. And more generally, we read also in Leviticus the instruction that the people were to be different from the nations which they removed, which we find to be presumably a motivation behind all of these reforms which King Asa led. But in particular, we think of this with regards to removing the Sodomites. So in Leviticus, chapter 18, verse 24, we read, "Defile not ye yourselves in any of these things, for in all these things the nations are defiled, which I cast out before you. And the land is defiled, therefore I do visit the iniquity thereof upon it." This is the very reason, or one of the reasons, which Israel were empowered, shall we say, to drive out these nations. It was a two-part thing, wasn't it? Yes, it was for Abraham's sake, but also on the other side, it was to drive out these nations, wasn't it, with their wicked ways, to punish them. Verse 26, "Ye shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations, neither any of your own nation, nor any stranger that sojourneth among you." Otherwise, that whole part of it's pointless, isn't it? To remove one set of people with another set that fulfill the same. "For all these abominations have the men of the land done, which were before you, and the land is defiled, that the land spew you not you out also when ye defile it, as it spewed out the nations that were before you." And of course, even though this was before the times that the nation of Israel entered in, obviously we think of a perfect example of that, don't we, with the punishment that was brought upon Sodom, from which Sodomites get their name. Which the angel said, "We will destroy this place because the cry of them is waxen great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord hath sent us to destroy it." The land spewed them out. Well, in this case, they were rained down upon, weren't they? But we wonder, these things were probably in the mind of King Asa when he initiated these reforms. He was probably very aware of that passage, that they do not like the nations that were there before them. Otherwise, what was the point in God giving them the land? As we say, we think this same motivation flows through to all of the reforms which King Asa performed. And so we move on to the removal of the idols. Reading from the Chronicles account this time, 2 Chronicles chapter 14. "For he took away," verse 3, "he took away the altars of the strange gods and the high places, and break down the images, and cut down the groves. Also he took away out of all the cities of Judah the high places and the images, and the kingdom was quiet before him." Sorry, we skipped over to verse 5 there. Well, which idols were these? Where did they come from? Were these the idols of the nations before them, sort of left over? Well, we've already partly seen the answer to this. We saw in 1 Kings 15, "And he took away the Sodomites out of the land, and he removed all the idols that his fathers had made." So these weren't just the idols which were already there in the land, leftovers that were yet to be cleaned up, so to speak, although there probably were some of those. But these were idols which they themselves had made. And more specifically, and we already saw this when we were assessing the character of Rehoboam, we read, didn't we, in 1 Kings 14, and verse 21. In fact, actually, since we've already read it, let's just jump down to 23. "For they also built them high places and images and groves on every high hill and under every green tree. So these were the idols of his fathers, quite literally, weren't they? It was of his grandfather in his days. These things were built, which makes that declaration of Abijah seem all the more thin, doesn't it? When he says, "We have not forgotten the Lord of our fathers." And so Asa comes in and starts to remove these idols, to take down these idols, to cut down these groves. And again, we don't have to dig deep into our scriptural knowledge to see where the motivation from that would come from, which commands would drive that. In fact, it's right there in the first of the Ten Commandments, wasn't it? It's commandment number one. "And God spake all these words," Exodus 20, verse 1 to 5, "saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image," which they had, "or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above," which they had, "or in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me." Now there's a passage which would have rung in the ears of Asa, wouldn't it? Third and fourth generation, grandson of Rehoboam, who made the idols. He couldn't just push this off as somebody else's problem. I didn't make these idols. They were here before I got here. This was his problem to deal with. He was the king. It was his responsibility. And he couldn't just pass it off. And we wonder if Asa, as a king with good intention, most likely followed those commands which we read of in our opening reading, to write himself a copy of the law. In which case he would have read and written, these very words with his own pen. Clearly, this was something of high priority to deal with to a man of spiritual outlook, a man who feared God and took his words seriously. And in a similar vein, they were told also to what to do with the idols of the nations which were already there. I perhaps should have put these passages in the other order. Numbers 33, verse 51. "Speak to the children of Israel and say unto them, when you are passed over Jordan into the land of Canaan, then shall you drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, and destroy their pictures, and destroy their molten images, and quite pluck down all their high places. And ye shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land, and dwell therein. For I have given ye to possess it." Dispossess, to put them out, to replace them, and all that came with them. I say, not just move into their houses and leave everything intact. And so it's fairly clear, isn't it, what Asa was to do. And it's clear that he did that. And we might think, well, there we go. Idolatry. It's fairly clear cut. It's a bad idea. It's the first commandment, and he dealt with it. But maybe it's worth just pausing for a moment to consider, why was idolatry a problem? What was so bad about idols? What were idols? Why were they so offensive to God? That's a stupid question, isn't it? Because it seems so obvious, doesn't it? Well, of course idols were offensive to God. But it's perhaps worth just scratching a little beneath the surface. Because perhaps it's a little bit too easy to misunderstand. I believe that Jewish painters, even to this day, they'll leave the faces off on the pictures because they don't want to be breaking that command. They understand it in a very literal sense. Well, let's not make a picture of anything. But we have to be careful, don't we, that we're not too simplistic about these things. So what are idols? Well, they're things which displace God, aren't they? If we just jump back a couple of passages. "I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt. Thou shalt have no other gods before me, or besides me." The things which displace God in what way? Take his grace in what way? Or anything which takes the love that is due to God. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy might. There's a full requirement. It's anything which takes away the trust in God. We think of how people acted with the idols, how they placed their trust in them. We think about how the other nations, they brought them to the battlefield sometimes, didn't they? They thought their gods would defend them. They're taking trust from God. And where was that trust due? Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. We can see how those idols gnawed away at that all, didn't they? They took away from it. And we can see so clearly where that was due. And service. The service to God. People served their idols, didn't they? They brought them their first fruits, for example. Made offerings to them. They gave them their children. They went out of their way for their idols. And where should that service have been due? And now, Israel, what doth the Lord thy God require of thee? But to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, to keep the commandment of the Lord and his statutes, which I command thee this day for thy good. Now, there's nothing there that's surprising, is it? We've just laid out the responsibilities to God, and we can see how the idols went against each of those requirements, can't we? People doing obeisance to this thing which wasn't God. That's taking away some of all of that love that was for God. They placed their trust in it. Their idol would protect them from a bad harvest, from this invading army, from bad luck. They served them, they brought them offerings when all of their service should have been to the Lord God. I'm sure you can see where I'm going with this. I don't suppose any of us have a statue in our house which we put baskets of food in front of. But what is it that maybe draws some of our love? Christ says, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. How about our trust? Where do we place our trust? Or where do we place some of our trust? Perhaps ourselves? We maybe place a little bit of trust in ourselves. We can figure this one out. We can get through this. We can do this. We're clever. We're resourceful. Perhaps money? Maybe desiring to have or having something for a rainy day, so to speak. Not bad in itself to make provision, but where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Where do we fundamentally trust? Perhaps the state. Maybe we look to the nation to look after us and to protect us. Or maybe more realistically, we worry that it won't. It's two sides of the same coin, isn't it? Perhaps science. Perhaps we take great interest in what science is doing to look after the human race, to look after our future, finding a way off the planet or resources which last forever. I know I get kept swept up in that. I find that interesting. Does it matter? We don't need to trust in the ingenuity of some person to figure out solutions to these things. And I'm not saying we deliberately make the problem worse, as I know seems to be the conclusion of perhaps some elements of the religious right in America, that sort of it's our right to pollute. But maybe we don't need to worry so much or to trust in science to be the solution. And what takes our service? or part of our service. No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. And so here's the thing. This is what Abijah forgot about, didn't he? We haven't done what you've done and given ourselves wholly over to idolatry. We've still got the priesthood and the temple and plenty of idols. He had a foot in both camps, didn't he? And what was the conclusion? King Abijah, it says that he did wickedly in the sins of his fathers. You can't have a foot in both camps. So these questions are very personal, aren't they? And they take introspection. And perhaps Paul spoke to it well, Paul the Apostle this time. All things are lawful unto me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. And so the answer won't be the same for each of us, of which things may be gnawed our trust and our attention, of our love and our service, because they might be things which, for one of us, they don't hold any power over us. But perhaps for another, it does hold some power over us. And so it's nuanced, isn't it? And that makes it difficult. And that makes it easy to ignore and easy to work our way out of. No idols in the house? Check. No idolatry. But I think perhaps this verse from Paul gives us a bit of something deeper to dig at, doesn't it? So what did Asa do about it? Well, he told them to stop worshipping the idols, didn't he? No, he didn't, did he? He didn't ask people to stop. He didn't command people to stop. He didn't put a fence around the idols and say, don't go near the idol. We're not worshipping the idols anymore. He removed the idols, didn't he? And so likewise then, how do we cut those ties? How do we remove the things which compete for our attention? Sometimes we have to be cruel to be kind to ourselves. Jesus said, and if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. For it is profitable for thee that one of thy members should perish, and not that thy whole body should be cast into hell. So sometimes these sacrifices, they're going to cut close to the bone, aren't they? The removal of the idols. Now, if we jump forward a few years to the second set of reforms, just for a moment, then Asa certainly knew that. We read in 2 Chronicles 15, later on, after some of the other things we're going to speak about today, we read, and concerning Maacah, the mother of Asa the king, he removed her from being queen because she had made an idol in a grove. And Asa cut down her idol and stamped it and burnt it in the brook Kidron. So even his own family. Now, in fact, it seems that it's actually his grandmother. I think the Hebrew word is somewhat ambiguous, but we can look to 2 Chronicles 11, verse 20. We read that Maacah was the wife of Abijah. But still family, the queen, person in the royal household. But again, we can find the motivating commands behind it. Deuteronomy chapter 13, anticipating this very circumstance. If thy brother, Deuteronomy 13 verse 6, if thy brother, the son of thy mother, or thy son, or thy daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or thy friend which is as thine own soul, entice thee secretly, saying, let us go and serve other gods, which thou hast not known, thou nor thy fathers, namely of the gods of the people which are round about you, nigh unto thee, or far off from thee, from the one end of the earth even unto the other end of the earth. Thou shalt not consent unto him, nor hearken unto him, neither shall thine eye pity him, neither shalt thou spare, neither shalt thou conceal him. Now Asa didn't conceal his mother's idolatry, did he? He took the idol out, cut it down, brought it to the brook Kidron. Now he may have been particularly aware of the risks which harbouring this idolatry would pose. He knew the dangers of a bad queen in the royal household. And perhaps he thought in particular of Solomon's downfall or stumble, depending on how he ended up, and the impact which his foreign wives had on him. Now, Maacah wasn't foreign, but she brought those attitudes which were foreign to the people of Israel, the idolatry. Because Rehoboam, his grandfather, Rehoboam's mother was one of Solomon's foreign wives, in fact. We read in 2 Chronicles 12, verse 13, "So King Rehoboam strengthened himself in Jerusalem and reigned. For Rehoboam was 140 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city which the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. And his mother's name was Naamah, an Ammonitess." This same Rehoboam who built these idols throughout the land, who constructed these groves, who led the nation of Israel so far astray, his mother was an Ammonitess, one of Solomon's foreign wives. And so maybe that was a further motivation to Asa to cut the problem out at the root, to not let that same acceptance of idolatry in the royal household work its evil ways. And so, as we say, he took the idols and broke them down and took them and cut down her idol and stamped it and burnt it at the brook Kidron. And it was a very symbolic act, wasn't it? Not even the mother or the queen or the grandmother was to get special treatment. It's a very shameful thing, wasn't it? You think how the royal household would normally have been treated amongst the people and the respect they normally would have been shown. And Asa said, "No, there's no respect here. We don't condone this." And it was burnt and ground to powder in the valley of the brook Kidron, which goes right down by the side of Jerusalem, a very visible place, looked down on by the temple area. Would have been quite easy for the city to see. It wasn't done quietly. She wasn't quietly removed and just put out to pasture, maybe given a piece of land somewhere in the north from the kingdom of, well, not the north, but somewhere out of the, away from Jerusalem. No, right there, on the doorstep of Jerusalem, it was broken to powder. A place that marked the boundary with Jerusalem. It's the place, if you remember, which Shimei was told not to pass over. It's the edge of Jerusalem, put out of the camp, so to speak. It was a place later used by Hezekiah, you may recall, when he performed a similar purging. And likewise, Josiah. Now, we haven't got time to go into those, but I'm sure you'll remember the circumstances. And so sometimes we have to make difficult sacrifices, don't we, in order to remove those bad influences. But again, Jesus reassures us, "Everyone that hath forsaken houses or brethren or sisters or fathers or mother or wife or children or lands for my name's sake shall receive an hundredfold and inherit eternal life." And so Asa drove out these idols from the land. And then we read also that he reinstated God into his rightful place. 2 Chronicles 14, verse 3, "For he took away the altars of the strange gods and the high places and break down the images and cut down the groves and commanded Judah to seek the Lord God of their fathers and to do the law and the commandment." And so clearly Asa understood that the two parts of his role, the nature, the importance of correcting this wayward nation. He removed the bad influences and he set up programs in place to make sure that everybody learnt the law. He commanded, it became a rule, they must learn the law. He knew it couldn't just be him and the priest. The nation needed to be educated. They needed to be brought back into line with where they should have been to make up for those years of evil rulership. And it perhaps reminds us, I'm sure you thought the same passage, of the parable of the unclean spirits. In Luke chapter 11, verse 24, when the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walketh through dry places, seeking rest. And finding none, he saith, I will return to my house whence I came out. And when he cometh, he findeth it swept and garnished, all the idols removed. Then goeth he and taketh to him seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter in and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. And so he understood that it wasn't enough just to take away the bad influence. And it's true for us too, isn't it? If we just put away whatever it is that's got the power over us, and we don't do anything to rebalance, to replace that care, that love, that attention, that trust, then our flesh will fill the void, won't it? There's a saying, isn't there? Nature abhors a vacuum. That's true, isn't it? Now, I'm sure you've come across this idea before and you'd be familiar with it as a demonstration. There's a pink elephant on that screen. Hopefully it looks pink on the projector, otherwise the whole point's somewhat moot, but it's pink on my screen. Now, I want you to not think about the pink elephant. You have to look at the screen as well. So I'm sure we've all heard this exercise or come across it. When the pink elephant is there, it's very difficult not to think about the pink elephant. I hope you're not thinking about the pink elephant. Still there, isn't it? Still don't want you thinking about that pink elephant. It's tricky, isn't it? To think of nothing when you've just seen the pink elephant. But if we put something else in its place, it's a lot easier now, isn't it? There's something else which we've put there. It's drawing your attention, isn't it? If you're anything like me anyway, trying to spot where the loop is. What's the marbles on the top plate for the clue? I'm going to have to hide that now. I don't think I've got a slide camera straight. Otherwise, you won't be listening to me. You'll be watching the marbles. That'll make the exact opposite point. But if we try and do nothing and explicitly think of nothing, we just put aside those bad influences. What's going to come back into our mind unbidden? What would have come back into the nation of Israel? But no, we can't leave the place swept. We have to replace it with something wholesome. Letter to Philippians. Finally, my brethren, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, if there be any praise, think on these things. Those things which ye have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do, and the God of peace shall be with you. And so that's what Asa set about doing, replacing those evil works. So what next? Well, he set about a program of doing as well, of building. 2 Chronicles 14, verse 6, and he built fenced cities in Judah, for the land had rest and had no war in those years, because the Lord had given him rest. Therefore he said unto Judah, let us build these cities and make about them walls and towers and gates and bars, while the land is yet before us, because we have sought the Lord our God. We have sought him, and he hath given us rest on every side. So they built and prospered. And so that seems an entirely rational thing to do, doesn't it? The land was at peace, took the opportunity to build, to strengthen while they weren't being harangued by aggressive nations. They built up the defences. Completely rational. And also, probably, if you're anything like me, completely not what we would have done. Because we're not especially rational creatures, are we? Naturally, when it's all going well, when things are at ease, we don't usually dig in and make preparation. Naturally, we maybe just throttle back a little. We think of the man who built the barns in the parable Jesus told. He thought to himself, saying, what shall I do? Because I have no room where to bestow my fruits. He said, this will I do. I'll pull down my barns and build greater. There will I bestow my fruits and goods. And what's his attitude at the end of that? I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. We're all right. It's peaceful. No one's coming. And we think how previously, under previous rulership, how Israel languished spiritually when at peace, without strong leadership. Rehoboam again. And it came to pass when Rehoboam had established the kingdom and had strengthened himself, he forsook the law of the Lord. Exactly the opposite. And all Israel with him. It was going well. And we see that pattern, don't we? You could line that up with those waves on that plot, couldn't you? It's going well and it all goes wrong again. Because they languished. And so there's a lot in that. There's a lot of strength in what Asa did, a lot of wisdom. It's rational, and that's what makes it all the more impressive for us. He built fenced cities in Judah. And what was his reasoning? He said, Therefore he said unto Judah, let us build these cities and make about them walls and towers and gates and bars while the land is yet before us. While we've got opportunity. And we're the same, aren't we? When do we tend to pray hardest? When are our prayers most fervent? When it's going well? Or when things are a bit sticky? Do we prepare? Are we digging in the good times while we can think straight? David understood this, another man of God. In the Psalms, just as one example, I mean, we pretty much use the large proportion of the book of Psalms as this example. We've picked this from Psalm 71, a few selected verses. Be thou my strong habitation, whereunto I may continually resort. Thou hast given commandment to save me, for thou art my rock and my fortress. Verse 17. O God, thou hast taught me from my youth, and hitherto I have declared thy wondrous words. Now also, when I am grey and old and grey-headed, O God, forsake me not. I have showed thy strength unto this generation, and thy power to every one that is to come. It was continual, wasn't it? And I've just realized I've been misreading the clock and I've got less time than I thought. So what else can we learn from these building works? That he was a humble man, wasn't he? If we look at that same verse again, why did he say they had peace? It wasn't because of his great, how intimidating he was and how the other nations were scared of him. No, it's because we have sought the Lord our God. He has given us rest. Again, that's a rare insight from a ruler, isn't it? But we might also we might find it perhaps a little paradoxical, though. God has given us rest. Let's build walls. And we might say, well, where was the trust? Did he trust in the walls, or was he trusting in God? But actually, that's a very simplistic point of view, isn't it? He recognized the opportunity God had given him to make himself stronger. And we can think of Hezekiah as another example. Hezekiah, we read, when Hezekiah saw Sennacherib was come, verse 2, and he was purposed to fight against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains, which were without the city, and they did help him. So there was gathered much people together, who stopped all the fountains, and the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water? Also, he strengthened himself and built up all the walls that was broken down and raised it up to the towers and another wall without and repaired Millo, the city of David, and made darts and made shields in abundance. Where was his trust? He set captains of war. Let's go down to verse 7. Be strong and courageous and be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria, nor for all the multitude that is with him. Why? Because of his walls and all the fortifications? No. Because there be more with us than with him. For with him is an arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help us fight our battles. So Hezekiah was the same. He took the opportunity, but he knew that it was God that would bring the victory. And it's the same for us, isn't it? We can't just pray for deliverance and then step back. Yes, we should pray. We should definitely rely on God, but we should also use the opportunities he gives us, in particular in the times when it's going perhaps a little easier. Spiritually prepare. And it was a good job he did prepare, wasn't it? Because there was war coming. The test was coming. Zerah of the Ethiopians. 2 Chronicles 14, verse 8. Asa had an army of men that bear targets and spears out of Judah, 300,000 out of Benjamin that bear shields and drew bows, and 280,000. All these were mighty men of valor. And they came against them Zerah the Ethiopian with a host of 1,000,000 and 300 chariots, and came unto Marishah. Now, Marishah, I'm afraid this is a modern map, but hopefully I'm sure you'll recognize the shape of things well enough to be able to place that. Marishah was a city that was originally settled by Judah when they moved into the land, and in fact it was built up by Rehoboam and made more significant. So it's coming down towards, obviously, unsurprisingly, down towards Egypt and towards Africa in direction from Jerusalem. So this is where the battle was met. And as we've seen there, if you add them up, the 380,000 of Benjamin, 200,000, on Asa's side, there was 580,000 versus 1,300,000 people. That's quite some army, isn't it? I don't know about you, but I'd struggle to picture even what that would begin to look like. 1 million people of any type would be intimidating, but an army of 1 million? Think of the psychological impact on Asa. This was a test, wasn't it? And that number, 300, maybe seems a bit minuscule compared to the 1 million. Oh, there were 300 chariots as well. But I was reading some material on chariots during that period, and it described what was considered to be a very significant battle involving chariots. This is a quote from a history website. The most famous chariot battle was that of Kadesh, fought between the two superpowers of the time, Egypt and the Hittites, where some 50 chariots are presumed to have participated from each side. That many, 50. The small number of chariots compared to infantry troops is a good indicator of how effective the chariot was. Now, the Ethiopians had 300. These were the tanks of their day. They could move quickly through the battlefield. They were well armored. They usually had archers on the back, sometimes several. They could nip in and out of the enemy lines, taking down people of significance. The archers were well trained. They could rush in, protected by the chariot, and pick off key figures. Imagine 300 of those racing backwards and forwards across the battlefield. It'd be an intimidating sight, wouldn't it? And like Hezekiah, later on, what does Asa do? Asa cried to the Lord his God and said, Lord, it is nothing with thee to help, whether with many or with them that have no power. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rest on thee, and in thy name we go against this multitude, O Lord. Thou art our God. Let no man prevail against thee. Now there's some words with some backing when he says we rest in thee. Such a contrast from his father. And I'm sure just reading those passages, the echoes are springing out, aren't they, to other accounts in Scripture. We think of Jonathan when he inspired his armor bearer against the Philistines. Jonathan said to the young man that bears armor, come, let us go over against the garrison of these uncircumcised, the whole garrison. It may be the Lord will work with us, for there is no restraint to the Lord to save by many or few. That's the attitude Asa had, wasn't it? And we think of David also. Let's look at the resonance there in those words. Thou art our God, let not man prevail against thee. We rest in thee. In thy name we go against this multitude. You probably think of David and Goliath. We won't go there for time. It's not a disadvantage to God to have few people. In fact, God prefers the underdog, so to speak. Remember Gideon. The Lord said unto Gideon, the people that with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, mine own hand hath saved me. Well, this should be reassuring for us, shouldn't it? Because look around. There aren't many of us. But it doesn't matter to God. Do ye see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. And God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. And base things of the world and things which are despised hath God chosen. Yea, and things which are not, to bring to naught the things that are. Why? That no flesh should glory in his presence. It's the same reason, isn't it, as ever? Because the trust should be in God. Well, God heard Asa. So the Lord smote the Ethiopians before Asa and before Judah, and the Ethiopians fled. And Asa and the people that were with him pursued them unto Gerar. And the Ethiopians were overthrown, all 1,000,000 of them, that they could not recover themselves, for they were destroyed before the Lord. Before the Lord, not before Asa, and before his host. And they carried away very much spoil. And they smote all the cities round about Gerar, for the fear of the Lord came upon them all. And they spoiled all the cities, and there was exceeding much spoil in them. And they smote also the tents of the cattle, and carried away sheep and camels in abundance, and returned to Jerusalem. Yes, Asa was victorious, wasn't he? The Lord was victorious. Asa went into that battle in the Lord's name, that the Lord's name might be feared, and the nations round about feared the Lord. He wasn't afraid when faced with 1,000,000. He'd prepared in those years of peace. He erected the walls. He'd strengthened the men, spiritually and physically. He commanded that they learn the law. He'd taken away the bad influences. Even when they were close to home. And they went out and stood before that host and said, "In your name we go. For God is able to save by many or few." And so, we'll just leave with this concluding thought. What shall we say unto these things? If God be for us, who can be against us?